Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, this is Billie Jean King.
This is Marion Bartoli.
I'm Mats Wilander.
This is Mary Carrillo.
This is Pam Shriver.
This is Yannick Noah.
This is Aaron Walls from San Francisco, California. And you're listening to David, Catherine, and Matt at The Tennis Podcast.
Well, hello and welcome to The Tennis Podcast, introduced today by Aaron Walls, who tells us that he is just back from a trip to Melbourne. Us too, Aaron. He says, as well as going to the tennis, he was visiting family because his mum is Australian. Aaron tells us that many years ago, his mum visited San Francisco from Melbourne and met his dad. They went to a Tony Bennett concert called I Left My Heart in San Francisco. He proposed, she said yes, and that's the reason he exists. So to everybody that has a shout out coming up on the Tennis Podcast, please know that the bar has been raised for backstory, and we now need to know the circumstances of your conception. That is where Aaron has raised the bar to. Thank you very much. Unclear, Aaron, whether did the proposal happen on their first date? That's something I'd like to know.
I can give you additional backstory if you want, Catherine, because it was all in the email, but I did give you an abridged version.
What was the time period between first date and proposal? That's what I'd quite like to know.
I don't think it was very long, but I do know that initially she said no, and then the additional trip to Tony Bennett happened. And then things turned around.
Wow. Okay. Big additional information. Thank you, Aaron, for introducing the show today. Aaron also tells us that when he was at the tennis in Melbourne, his highlight of the tournament was Adrian Mannarino against Ben Shelton. And we recorded our Australian Open review show this week. We've been intending to record it while we were still in Melbourne, but David was obviously feeling under the weather at the back end of that trip. You'll notice that David is back. Welcome back, David.
So we recorded our
review show when we got back. And it's great, by the way. Do become a friend of the Tennis Podcast in order to listen. But somehow, Mannarino against Shelton didn't come up, did it? And yet, Matt, I would say that watching that with you and cameraman Matthew definitely was one of my very favourite moments of the tournament.
Yeah, mine too. We went for the Ben Shelton show, didn't we? And we actually got the Adrian Mannarino show. Like, it was kind of remarkable, the things that he was doing with that loosely strung racket of his. And yeah, of course, this was the match where we got the answer to that question: what is Adrian Mannarino doing? And he told us that the answer is tequila, which is one of the quotes of the year, I think, already.
Yeah, definitely do drink tequila if you're playing Ben Shelton. Definitely don't drink tequila if you're playing Novak Djokovic. That's what we learned from Adrian Mannarino in Melbourne this year. Incidentally, I saw my dad in the week. In fact, Matt and I both saw David Whittaker in the week because he came to pick us up from Heathrow Airport. And I asked him, because he's a racket stringer by trade these days, and I asked him whether he had any client requests for the Mannarino, and he said not yet. So Mannarino's influence hasn't hasn't quite trickled down to the grassroots yet, but we will watch the situation very closely. David, it's great to have you back. How are you doing?
Oh, thank you very much. Very, very well now that I am. What are we, sort of 5 days into the jet lag recovery, and I feel like I'm getting somewhere. So, you know, I'm still getting up at 5-something every morning, but that's better than expected. So very happy to be back and chatting to you two again.
David did Pilates this morning. Matt's already played tennis this morning. We're Daniil Medvedev, aren't we? It's new year, new us.
Yeah.
Did you win, Matt?
No.
Also new year, same us. Tennis, of course, will never change. It just keeps happening. There has been such a ridiculous amount of tennis happening this week, considering it feels like it should just be a recovery week for everybody. But tennis has other ideas, folks. We've had WTA events in Linz, Austria, a 500, in Hua Hin, Thailand, a 250, and we've had an ATP event in Montpellier, a 250, and we've had Davis Cup qualifiers taking place all over the world. Let's start in Linz, Austria, because that is the points-wise the biggest event that we've had this week, and it was won by Yelena Ostapenko, who beat Ekaterina Alexandrova quite handily in the final. In fact, Yelena Ostapenko is keeping up one of, well, I mean, it's early days, but one of my favourite stats of 2024 so far, which is that Yelena Ostapenko is unbeaten against players that aren't Victoria Azarenka. And my sort of sliding doors counterfactual that I'm desperate to know about and never will is what would have happened if she hadn't got Victoria Azarenka so early in the Australian Open draw. I mean, she is playing serious tennis, potentially the best tennis of her career, and she's doing it consistently at the moment. She's doing it week in, week out. Okay, it's early days in the season, but this is already as sustained a period of consistency as I think we've ever seen from Yelena Ostapenko.
It's the first time she's won two titles in a season since 2017, of course, her Grand Slam title winning season. And, you know, it's only the first week of February, and she's already done that. And I think she's been to the final of every event that she's played so far this season, either in singles or doubles. You know, if she hasn't made it in singles, she's got there in doubles. Like, I just did not have consistency on my bingo card, really, for Ostapenko at all, ever. And so it is really impressive to see her doing that. And I think this week I would sort of add resilience as a word that I was impressed with, because, you know, as I said, she was in the Australian Open doubles final. She then flew all the way to Linz and was down to Clara Towson in that first round, and could very easily have lost that match, ended up coming through it in a deciding set tie break. And then once she'd got that match sort of out of the way, she just absolutely thrashed everyone else that she played in the entire week. She is just in such good form at the moment. And yeah, against everyone except Azarenka, as you said, one of my favorite graphics that I've ever seen in tennis was Roger Federer at the, I think it was the 2006 French Open, where graphic comes up. You know, so we're sort of midpoint of the season there, and the graphic says that he's 44-0 against everyone not named Rafael Nadal that year, and he's 0-3 against Rafael Nadal to start 2006, and it feels like Ostapenko's got her own little thing going on, because yeah, she's I think 13-0 against everyone else and 0-2 against Azarenka, but yeah, like, such a fun addition to the tour, I think, Ostapenko being relevant and consistent and winning big. Yeah, sort of long may it continue.
I think particularly as well, because she can actually hurt the very best players. I think there's a big question mark over her against Rybakina because of the difference in their serves. But we've seen what Ostapenko did to Świątek. I feel like she can hurt Sabalenka if Sabalenka doesn't have a good serving day, and because she has no respect for reputations. Not that she doesn't respect other players, but she never lets anything stop her. You know, you mentioned in earlier the Mannarino contrast between when he played Ben Shelton and then when he played Novak Djokovic. And look, I think matchup-wise, that's a bad one for him against Djokovic. But I just get the sense as well that maybe he doesn't really believe that he can beat the guy, belongs in his company in the same way. And then you get Ostapenko. She believes she can beat anybody and that she probably should beat them all. And what did she say? Her New Year's resolution was to be more aggressive. Seems to be working.
Yeah, doesn't it just? I mean, I always think with Elena Ostapenko when I'm sort of speculating on, you know, what does it all mean? How far can she go? And I'm sort of trying to convince myself, you know, she's a Grand Slam champion. She's back in the top 10. It could happen then. And then I remember her serve, and in particular her second serve, and I think, oh, you know, that's just always going to hold her back. But then it's got it. You know, she's got this far. Maybe she's just the absolute master of protecting a weakness, which is, you know, one of Carrillo's three laws, isn't it? Yeah, such a fun addition to the top 10. And I think in Adelaide, when she won Adelaide, that was when she sealed her return to the singles top 10. I think I remember thinking, well, that's cool, but also thinking that's, you know, she's probably not going to be a fixture there. You know, maybe she'll bob in and out a bit, but I'm starting to think, oh, maybe Elena Ostapenko could qualify for the finals wherever they are, and wouldn't that be fun to have her there?
Do you know, I also wonder, watching her sometimes, do you ever feel like what would have happened had she not won the French Open? Now, obviously, she would have been without a Grand Slam title there, but did that hold her back in some way from developing in a normal way? You know, if you think back all the outcome of a Grand Slam, the hype that comes with it, the attention, you know, it came at her pretty out of the blue, didn't it? I don't have an answer to that, but it's one of those I'd be almost fascinated to know what that slide indoors might have led to.
Well, we'll never know, but what I would say is, It's a good model, isn't it, of how it can take quite a lot of time after such a life-altering event, such as winning a Grand Slam totally out of the blue. And obviously there are very direct parallels here to Emma Raducanu. And once again, I was in the pub last night, ended up chatting to a couple of people nearby and who might be listening now. Actually, they did leave the pub saying, oh, I'm going to look up your tennis podcast. But Emma Raducanu came up, and it was, you know, what's happened to her, which for a casual tennis fan in the UK is a legitimate question, I think. It's just, I sigh at sort of the answer, because there's just so much you want to say and so much that we don't know. But I do kind of want to point to Elena Ostapenko as an example of how it can take a really, really long time, and she's still incredibly young, Ostapenko, and might very well still have her best years ahead of her. I mean, if she can only lose to Victoria Azarenka, who knows what's possible for her?
and she did actually back up winning the slam quite well in the first year. I remember, I think she got to, in 2018, didn't she do well in Miami? And I think she also did pretty well at Wimbledon that year. Like, I think those are probably her best results at the biggest events since her slam title, you know, in the year that immediately followed. But sort of since then, she hasn't really been able to play this style of tennis over seven matches, and I think that is still the question mark. You know, like a title run in Linz is, you know, brilliant, but it's only four matches, and you know, when you play that high risk tennis that she does, it's just very hard to sustain it, I think, over a whole tournament. And I think, you know, last year's US Open is probably the absolute classic example of that. She could not have been better against Iga Świątek, and then she could not have been worse in the next round against Coco Gauff. And that, along with her serve, are the two things that I would still say it feels like quite a long way for her to win another major. But if she can actually like somehow manage to sustain it, then and not run into Victoria Azarenka, then sort of anything is possible for her. It's really exciting.
It's a 500 now, Linz. You might be thinking this is a strange place for it to be in the calendar. It used to be at the end of the year in the post US Open indoor hard court swing. It's now been upgraded to a 500 event and finds itself in this, you know, post Australian Open, pre Sunshine double swing nether zone. There are quite a few WTA events that have been upgraded to 500s, I think. You know, it's a big opportunity for some players to pick up big points, but it is one of those you look at and go, wow, gosh, that's a 500. That's a little bit weird.
And there was a classic Ostapenko line about that, because she reached the final of Linz when it was a 250. I think she lost to Coco Gauff in the final, Coco Gauff's first title back in 2019. And, you know, she said, I'm glad I won it now, because, you know, it's a 500. And also, like, they've upgraded the trophy and it was much shinier and nicer and better. And she was like, yeah, I'm pleased I got this one rather than that other one.
I do like that they've upgraded the trophy to reflect the tournament's new status. I do think that's cool. And there are some very Yelena Ostapenko-esque iconic photos of her with that trophy that if you're feeling low, I'd suggest you try and take a look at, because they are great. The WTA 250 event in Hua Hin, Thailand was won by Diana Schneider, the Russian whose name you might remember from a run she had at the Australian Open last year. She is, she was a US college player that had to make the decision about whether to go pro and take her third round, I think it was, Australian Open prize money, or whether to stay an amateur and stay playing for her college team for the remainder of the season, which she had committed to do. She is now pro, and she is now a title winner in Hua Hin. And I'm a big believer in Diana Schneider. This is one where I feel very pleased for her, but I also feel pleased for me, because it's just a little bit of validation for a player that I've been banging on about for a little while, without the results quite reflecting it. But she's officially happening now, David.
It is one of the things I love about the sport and about the podcast and things like that. It is, there are certain players I just associate with certain people, and Yulia Niemeyer, I will always think of Hannah, who christened her a Wimbledon champion of the future when she first saw her. And with Matt, it's obviously Nicholas Jarry. With me, it's probably Arthur Fils and Maxime Cressy. Name another 25 from about the last 10 years who've probably gone on to do next to nothing. But with you, Catherine, it has always been Diana Schneider. Why?
Oh, why do I think she's good?
Why do you like her so much? I mean, like, when I turn on the TV, and or what's the point, when I saw the tweet, I have to say I've had a really hard job this last week keeping up with all this tennis. I really wasn't ready for this at all. But so suddenly Diana Schneider's in the final and winning it, right? So I didn't know about the fact she'd been on this run. I saw this and the first thing I thought was, oh, Catherine's going to be chuffed. And I really want to know why it is. I think she looks really cool. I like her bandana and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
But I'm curious as to what got you with her.
Well, sorry to sound incredibly frivolous in my analysis, but the bandana is quite a big part of it. I do think that's incredibly cool. She's the only. There are no other bandana wearing tennis players. It's no. Really, really cool. I love it. She is a lefty. She's very, very intense. She looks just so busy on a tennis court. She's one of those players that if I'm watching a match, and look, I haven't seen her all that much. She hasn't been around all that much. She's still only 19. But if I'm watching a match that she's involved in, I end up just watching her side of the court quite a lot. She just, catches my eye. And she's got power. She's got serious power. I felt the same as you, David, with tennis this week. It was a bit of a struggle, but it did look to me like the movement had improved a bit, as you'd expect. And I just think she's really fun and interesting. Perfect alchemy of cool personality. Clearly has something about her. I always think players that have been to college, they just, even if they've only been for a year or two, not necessarily even completed their degrees, like they just have slightly more about them on average. They just have slightly more experience and perspective on the world. I think she's good news. And look, it's a 250 title in a not hugely competitive field. But it's still massive. It's still a benchmark ticked off, isn't it? She beat Magda Linette. She beat Zhu Lin in the final, as she beat Paola Badosa as well. So it's not nobody's. And I'm really interested to see how she can take it into Miami and Indian Wells. And I think her ranking is up to about 70 in the world. 73 is her singles ranking. So she should, I think, be getting into those events directly now, which feels quite a big, you know, jump up for her. I want to see her against the best.
Yeah. And by the way, one of my favourite Andre Agassi periods was when he was wearing a bandana in 1995. And he went on a run in which he won the Australian Open, Miami, Toronto. He won all sorts. So, you know, bandanas, I'm telling you.
It's interesting that didn't create a sort of a wave of bandana-wearing tennis players, Agassi's success.
I remember
until Diana Schneider.
Yeah, I remember walking the corridors of the tournament in Basel in 1998, my first year on the tour as an ATP communications manager, his comeback year, and we're walking around this corridor, and one of the pictures on the wall that they had was of him in his bandana era 3 years earlier. And and I remember walking and saying, oh, the bandana, you played the best tennis of your life wearing the bandana, didn't you? And he goes, I did, actually. Little did we know he would actually usurp that the following year by winning the French Open out of the blue and then the US Open. And he didn't have a bandana. But still, it was a look he pulled off. And now I'm very delighted to see somebody else coming along with it.
I remember when I watched her briefly in US Open qualifying last year, the members of her team were also wearing bandanas on the sideline, which I thought was a nice touch.
I don't know what she looks like without it. I have no idea.
No, I don't ever want to find out.
I don't want to.
It's like when we saw Matt without his glasses on very briefly in Australia, and I felt discombobulated for quite some time afterwards. The ATP tour this week has been in Montpellier. The title there was won by Alexander Bublik. He beat Borna Coric in the final and set a record. I think he's become the first ATP player to win a title after coming from a set down in every single match that he played to win said title. Is that right, Matt?
Yeah, which, I mean, You could have given me 100 guesses as to which player would end up with that stat, and I would not have come up with Alexander Bublik. I had a look at his record last year from a set down, and he won twice. And this tournament, he won four in a row from
a
set down. Yeah, it's absolutely wild. He won twice from a set down last year and lost 25 times.
Wow.
Here he is setting a record like that. It was absolutely wild. But in a way, I suppose it does make sense, because Alexander Bublik is the kind of guy who does things that you don't expect. So it's both the sort of most unlikely Bublik stat to have, but also perhaps, you know, it makes sense because he just does things that are a little bit wild and a little bit crazy. And yeah, it was a phenomenal run to the title. I watched him closely in the final against Chorich, and like, he is a better player than I realised. Like, in my head, Bublik is all, you know, first serves as second serves and slice backhands and trick shots and giving opponents no rhythm. And, you know, there is a lot of that. And I think his best tennis is sort of when it's improvised and creative and he's able to sort of make it flow even under a pressure situation. It's kind of a skill that he has. But actually, he can really knuckle down and rally and defend and sort of do a lot of things that you, I suppose, need to do to be able to win matches from a set down. And I was just sort of really, really impressed with him all week. And yeah, like, again, he's a fun addition. Like, I don't see him in the same terms as Ostapenko, in terms of, like, I think Ostapenko, as she's shown, is capable of winning at the very, very highest level. I do think the just relentless brilliance of most of the top players is going to be too much for Bublik to sort of keep up with. But he can pop up in weeks like this. He's won four titles now, Montpellier a couple of times. And it's just always fun to watch him play tennis.
We also had latest player to puke in a bin. The puke in a bin theory. Well, no. I mean, the puke in a bin theory, has the puke in a bin theory been disproven, or has it just been proven to be a purely Jannik Sinner related theory? Well, but there's Jack Draper as well.
Yeah.
Basically, puking in a bin didn't work for Felix Auger-Aliassime, is what I'm trying to say.
I don't agree. He went and won that match for a start, and he got to the semi-finals. No, he didn't win the tournament, but who knows what it leads to. We're messing around, but at the same time, I do think it shows great perseverance and determination to feel as badly as he was obviously feeling and going and winning anyway. And that's the theme with all three of those. Now, I find Felix Auger-Aliassime a really sad story at the moment because he had so much hype, and I realise that people like me are also to blame as part of that, putting the pressure on him. And he's had these incredible moments. He's won the Davis Cup. But he is having a tough time overall in his singles career at the moment. And I think back to him absolutely thrashing Sinner at a tournament early last year, something like 6-2, 6-1 or something like that. Now, Sinner was a different player back then too. But if Sinner can do what he's doing, why can't Felix Auger-Aliassime do something similar, really? Are they that different as tennis players? I don't think they are. I don't think they are. I really don't.
Oh, I think Jannik Sinner is a lot better than Felix Auger-Aliassime.
At the moment he is, but I don't think he should be. I think Auger-Aliassime should be looking at that and thinking, I killed this guy in a match last year. And if my game is on, it hurts people. Why isn't it hurting people more often, more relentlessly?
Look, there's no doubt that Felix Auger-Aliassime should be doing better than he is and has been doing. I know injury has been a part of that, but I definitely don't think the full part of it. But I don't think there is anywhere near the upside to his game that there is with Sinner's. I mean, Sinner has pretty much totally equal weaponry on the forehand and the backhand, and Felix has got a massive deficit on the backhand. I just don't think he's as instinctive a tennis player as Jannik Sinner. I think he's sort of mechanical in a way that Jannik Sinner isn't. That look, he should be doing better, but I don't think even peak Auger-Aliassime has Grand Slams in him, really. Not with the caliber of how good everybody else is and how good his generation is proving to be. I don't know. Matt's always been the great Auger-Aliassime believer, so you might have you might have support there.
I don't know. I think I'm more with you on this one, Catherine.
Oh.
I think there's some sort of slight inherent doubt that I think Orge Aliassim has when he plays, in a way that I think Sinner has right now full trust in his game. And I feel like with Orge Aliassim, when I watch him, I almost feel like I'm sort of waiting for it to go a bit wrong. Because I can see him feeling that a little bit. I don't know whether I'm totally reading too much into it, but I don't know. Like, I just trust Sinner's mentality in a way that I don't trust Orge Aliassim right now. And I think you're right. Like, maybe back end of 2022, when he was winning all those matches indoors and he carried Canada to the Davis Cup in much the same way that Sinner carried Italy, okay, without, you know, beating Novak Djokovic along the way. But, you know, still a similar thing, putting his country on his shoulders and delivering. Right there was probably when I most believed in Orge Aliassim, and it did feel like he was confident. But sort of all other points in his career, I'm sort of waiting for him to crack a bit. And I do think some of the sort of mechanical nature of his game is part of that. You can see it all thinking. It's not as instinctive as I think it is with Sinner. And I mean, he has got a very good indoor record, Orge Aliassim. Like, I did think he would probably go on to win this title, and he's lost to the eventual champion in Bublik. So I do think, like, indoors he's been pretty good, really, Orge Aliassim. But he is in a tough spot in his career at the moment.
I would say, though, David, the thought process, the mentality that you described of you know, I beat this guy less than a year ago, there's no reason I can't be doing what he's doing, that's absolutely what Felix Orge Aliassim should be thinking. He definitely shouldn't be listening to me. That's what his mind should be telling him, whether it's true or not. So further evidence that everybody needs a hype man like David Law.
it is. I think you've both got it nailed on there. It's, I mean, look, there is a discrepancy between their two backhands, a big one, and yeah. That provides a vulnerability to Orge Aliassim, just nuts and bolts wise. But the big difference is that look in his eye as he's walking around on the court, is the waiting for it to go wrong, which I think you had it with Sinner for a while, last year even, when there were certain matches when he just wasn't as convincing. But post-puke, he's a different guy. And who knows? Maybe that's Felix's moment. But I just hope, I'd love to see Orge Aliassim fulfil his potential, which I do believe is a little bit above where he's already been. And he's already been quite far. Will he ever get back there is a big question mark right now.
Do we need to be worried about the prevalence of pukey and bins in men's tennis? Is that, feels like it, that's happening more and more. Is it just that bins are being made more readily available? People used to do their puking in private. I don't know the answers to any of these questions. I'm just throwing it all out there. I feel like public puking has become quite a big part of our podcasting lives. Well, if you know the answer,
watch the space.
Let us know. Just at Tennis Podcast. Before we come on to talk about some other bits and bobs of news from the week in tennis, there have been Davis Cup qualifiers over the weekend. Matt, you've been covering them for the ITF. Could you distill it down to some key headlines for us?
Yes, I would start by saying that, like, I find it really interesting because this is traditional Davis Cup. This is home and away ties, 12 of them. This is what everyone wants the competition to be. And yet it kind of made almost no noise in the tennis world, which I think was sort of always the problem. Like, you know, it's sort of pigeonholed into this weekend after the Australian Open. It doesn't feel like it's got its own space in the calendar. And if you watch any of these ties, you will think, oh, this is peak tennis. Like, Everyone is into it. The atmospheres are incredible. And yet, why is there kind of no wider buzz? Why is it not, you know, why is everyone not watching this? Why is it not available to watch everywhere, you know? So that's sort of how I would sort of preface it all. I think the big headline is Serbia are out. Novak Djokovic was not playing for them. They had Kecmanovic and Lajovic. And, you know, it's just quite interesting, isn't it? Novak Djokovic said last year what a priority Davis Cup was for him. But I think it's always so fascinating because he's not totally in control of Serbia's fate in the Davis Cup, you know, whether that be whoever else is playing singles or the doubles. But, you know, if he doesn't go to the qualifying tie, it's totally out of his control. But even so, you know, in Serbia, they picked the surface, they went for clay, that favours Kecmanovic and Lajovic, and they were beaten pretty handily by Slovakia with our friend from the Australian Open, Lucas Klein, who we so enjoyed watching. He delivered a singles win and a doubles win for Slovakia. So he sort of carried on that good form that he did have at the Australian Open. Croatia also out, one of the sort of big tennis nations over the past few years. They lost to Belgium. And then there were three ties that all went to a decider. Netherlands beating Switzerland with Bortic van der Zandschulp winning the crucial match. An amazing atmosphere there with all the Dutch fans in their orange suits, you know, as we've become used to seeing. Chile beat Peru in a decider, despite Nicolas Jarry losing to a guy ranked outside of the top 400 on day one. He did redeem himself.
He's having a great year, Jarry, is he?
Well, he did redeem himself on day two and get a must-win singles victory. And then Alejandro Tabilo got the crucial point there. And honestly, the scenes. I mean, Nicolas Massu, who is a gold medal winner for Chile in singles and doubles, you know, it seemed like this was the peak of his life when Chile won that. He was in tears on the side, incredible scenes. And then probably the best tie was Argentina-Kazakhstan, which was one of the ones I was covering, played in Rosario in Argentina in 40 degree heat. They were literally spraying the people in the crowd with water because it was so hot. I sort of felt for everyone involved. And yet it delivered this incredible tie where, you know, Kazakhstan, obviously without Alexander Bublik, because he was busy winning Montpellier, but they had this guy, Timofey Skatov, who was a former junior number one, but had only ever had one top 100 win in his entire life. He beat two top 30 players on clay in Argentina. He beat Cerundolo and he beat Echeverri to take Kazakhstan into a deciding match. And that match was Popov against Baez. Popov had two match points in the final set tiebreak, but Sebastian Baez reeled off 4 points in a row and Argentina won. And they're now on a six-match winning streak at home, and there were just absolutely incredible scenes there as well. But like an amazing effort from Kazakhstan to take it all the way to that deciding set tiebreak in the deciding match, despite, you know, a huge ranking differential between the teams. So yeah, like really good, fun stuff, but stuff that was hard to watch and hard to find, and doesn't have the same cut through as the tour events. And it's a shame because, like, yeah, you watch any of these ties and they're all like amazing fun.
Thanks, Matt. Glad we could cover that in such detail.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hello, Tennis Podcast listeners. David here. Now, you might know that I love a bit of cooking, and I think I'm quite good at it. But if I'm honest, even I get fed up trying to work out what to do every night. That's where Home Chef comes in. Being able to put together a delicious meal without the long prep and the cook times, well, that's pretty cool. Home Chef provides fresh ingredients and chef-designed recipes conveniently delivered to your doorstep to simplify your cooking experience. They have over 30 options a week and serve a variety of dietary needs, so you don't have to worry about what to make ahead of time. Not only is it convenient, but it's economical too. Home Chef customers save an average of $86 per month on groceries. Now, for a limited time, Home Chef is offering Tennis Podcast listeners 18 free meals plus free dessert for life and, of course, free shipping on your very first box. Go to homechef.com/tennis. That's homechef.com/tennis for 18 free meals and free dessert for life. You heard it right.
Before we talk about the tennis that is happening this week, there were some bits and bobs of news from the tennis world from the week that has just gone by. We've had the Marseille Open Twitter account versus Jannik Sinner. It's my new favourite rivalry, David.
It was so much fun. This was I'd been monitoring Marseille's Twitter activity because of how excited they were getting about Jannik Sinner's progress at the Australian Open and winning the title. And, you know, this is what you do. I've worked at Queen's and players have had a run at the French Open and you're getting excited because they're coming to you next, you know. And Sinner was signed up to play Marseille. And so, the really jolly tweet about this. Next tweet, Sinner snubs Marseille. And Catherine, a fluent French speaker, I think you just that was your moment of discovering what snubbed is in French, correct?
Didn't know the word snubbed in French. a massive omission from Nottingham University in my undergraduate degree. But on my next trip to France for the French Open, I will be finding ways to introduce snob into conversation with random French people.
You can say that Roland Garros snubs the women in the night session. We will get a rollout.
Yeah. Nightly rollout. Okay. And I mean, listen, just the sheer childishness of the response was just epic from Marseille, because so often, and I've been in this situation before, you get a player pull out on you and you're gutted, and it does go through your mind to say what you really think on those official channels, but you don't. You rise above and you play the big guy. And you say, oh, totally understand that Jannik Sinner couldn't come after winning the Australian Open. Hope he's back here next year. And to see an official account think, no, screw that. I'm pissed off and I'm going to tell everybody about it. Jannik Sinner snubbed us and I don't like it. and they got a lot of pushback from followers, and they eventually deleted it. But they didn't just delete it. They then replaced it with something which wasn't that much more sort of making.
They just
amends.
Replaced the word snubbed, didn't they?
They for, did, yes.
And then they just snubbed.
Then they did several replies to people asking questions and refused to back down and were not apologising for being annoyed. It was just wonderful.
It's indicative, isn't it, of, look, these 250 events, I mean, generally 250 events, there's the odd one that punches above its weight, but in a extremely crowded market where even for the biggest tennis fans, there is too much tennis, especially in you know, the few weeks after a Grand Slam. It's really, really hard for these events to have major international relevance and cut through. That's just a fact. But when you're in them and working on them or attending them, or you're in Montpellier, it's the absolute center of your universe, and it's what a lot of people work 51 weeks a year on, and that's absolutely lovely, isn't it? And they get sellout crowds at those events. Pretty much all of the French events do, and I can understand being so much in that bubble of, but this is everything to us. How dare Jannik Sinner treat it like it's just collateral damage after his big win? How dare he treat us like we're nothing? So I do get that kind of parochial sort of sensitivity to someone, you know, thinking, oh, I'm too big for that now. And yet I also think it was absolutely the right thing for Jannik Sinner to do.
If he'd have played it, we'd have thought he was mad.
Marseille should have seen it coming, really. Like, rather than massively celebrating his reaching the end of the Australian Open, they perhaps should have gone, this diminishes our chances of him coming. Maybe we should back off promoting him. But look, I get it, and it's sort of quite sweet, really, if ill advised from a PR point of view. Holger Rune and Severin Lucy, one of the, I think the record for shortest ever coach player partnership probably belongs to Jimmy Connors and Maria Sharapova currently, but I think coming in a hot second we might have Holger Rune and Severin Lucy. Blink and you missed it. What's happened here?
I did read some quotes from Rune's mother, I think, saying just was quite clear this wasn't going to work or something along those lines.
She referenced scheduling conflicts, which I would have thought would be something that you worked out like at the start. And, you know, I think Severin Luthi wasn't going to be able to give as much time to Holger Rune as they thought, you know, given that he seems to sort of play every event going. Like, that would probably require being on the road all the time if he's going to be there as his primary coach at all the events. And it sounds like Severin Luthi didn't want to do that. And honestly,
he did
like
a photo.
It is just kind of indicative that I do think that it's all a bit messy around Rune at the moment. Like, he's got the game, he's got the talent, but, you know, Jannik Sinner is a perfect example of how organized and sort of long-term thinking there is in that team, and everyone's on the same page, and it doesn't really feel like that with Holger Rune. And even the fact that he is so often playing while injured, I mean, he unfortunately had to retire in Montpellier this week. It seemed to be a sort of forearm, elbow, wrist, I couldn't quite tell, but, you know, not good. And It does feel like that sort of all the sort of organization part of his life seems to be slightly holding him back. As an outside observer, that's what it feels like anyway.
Yeah, there was a big magazine spread in Denmark, wasn't there, of Holger and his mum. And while his mum is sort of a very interesting and in many ways iconic figure in tennis at the moment, like, it's an incredibly amusing photo shoot. The front cover is him sort of sitting there, and she's got her hand on his shoulder from behind. It's really weird. And look, I've got nothing against her personally. She seems lovely. I know friends at the ATP that have done some shooting with Holger Rune and family back home in Denmark, and they all report that she and the whole family are absolutely lovely. However, I don't think it's an accident that successful tennis players, not that parents can't be involved, but, you know, like we were saying at the end of the Australian Open about Coco Gauff, now talking about taking responsibility for her decision. She's still a teenager. Her parents still travel with her. They're involved in her life, and that's fine. But she's in charge. She's a grown-up in the room, just like they are. You know, Sabalenka's talked about that as well, taking greater responsibility kind of within the team environment. It doesn't seem or sound to me like Holger Rune is there yet. He doesn't seem to be the CEO of Holger Rune Inc. right now, is how it appears to me. And I think being in charge and taking responsibility is important regardless of who your parents are. I don't think it's about them being good people or making good decisions or wanting what's best for you. I'm quite sure she's all of that. I just think kind of regardless, maybe he has some growing up to do. But he's still incredibly young. That can happen. And let's hope it does, because I do love his tennis. But yeah, it does seem pretty chaotic at the moment. Andy Murray, David, is entering his angry tweet era.
He's had a few of those over the course of the last 15 years, intermittently, hasn't he?
Mm.
Yeah. This was something that came off the back of a piece written by a colleague of ours, Kerradine from the BBC, somebody that I've known for many, many years. He's covered Andy Murray. He works for BBC Scotland and has travelled for more than a decade just going to tennis tournaments to cover Andy Murray. And if Andy Murray lost, he would go home, basically. Or if Jamie Murray was still in the doubles, he'd cover that. And he wrote a piece over the last week about the journey of Andy Murray, and off the back of the defeat that he had last week, which was a particularly heartbreaking one for him because he lost to Benoit Paire, having won the first set. He was in a second set tiebreak. Paire hadn't won a match for 18 months, and Paire, in front of his own fans in Montpellier, went and won that match. And it did mean that this is a really long period of matches without wins for Andy Murray. It's not been a good time. So he wrote this piece, did Kerradine, on the BBC Sport website, and did include a line that I must say, when I read it, I did think, oh, I don't agree with that personally. I'm not sure about that. And the gist of it was, how much more of this can happen before Murray starts to tarnish his legacy? And well, Andy Murray immediately, having read this piece, picked up on that line, and he tweeted, "Tarnishing my legacy? Do me a favour. I'm in a terrible moment right now. I'll give you that. Most people would quit and give up in my situation right now. But I'm not most people, and my mind works differently. I won't quit. I will keep fighting and working to produce the performances I know I'm capable of." That's what Andy Murray tweeted. And oh my goodness, did that create waves. Because, I mean, look, Andy Murray's got an absolutely massive social media following. He's got 3.5 million people who follow him. And anything he tweets tends to get responses and picked up on. He always causes people to feel things. Is one of the reasons I think he's one of my favourite athletes ever, is that I feel things when he talks and when he plays, no matter what he does. And I think a lot of people feel like that. But in this instance, it did seem to just bring everybody out into the conversation, and we had Andy Roddick, and we had lots and lots of other players just replying and kind of saying, how dare anybody suggest that Andy Murray shouldn't be doing what he wants to do, and he can finish whenever he wants to finish, and all this sort of thing. And I don't really think that Kerradine was saying anything other than that, really, but he was pointing out generally that it's not going very well at the moment, and how much longer can he keep this up? And I think that that's actually a fair point. I really disagree with the tarnishing of the legacy element. I think Andy Murray could never win another tennis match in the rest of his career and still play for another 2 years. It still wouldn't tarnish his legacy for me at all. I still think that Andy Murray can stop playing whenever he feels like. That's entirely up to him also. But I also think it's a perfectly legitimate article to write about the situation Murray finds himself in. He very nearly retired. We thought he'd retired 5 years ago. He's worked miracles to become a tennis player again with his metal hip and all the rest of it and everything that went on in that documentary resurfacing. It's an incredible story. It's already a success story. But it does appear to have hit a bit of a brick wall now. And what sort of ending is he going to have in the end? What will he choose to have? When will he choose to bow out? These are conversations we have all the time because they're going on in his head all the time. I've asked him that specific question at the US Open last year. He said, I think about this and reevaluate it all the time. Perfectly understandably so. He wants to try to choose the right time at whatever that is. I understand why he got inflamed by this particular article because of that one line about tarnishing his legacy and because he's going through a tough time. I do understand why he reacted to that. I hate the pile-on. I absolutely hate the, oh, Andy Murray said something, we're all going to get involved, you know, we're all coming for you, Kerry Dean. And I just don't like that stuff. Yeah, I was happy to stay away from it personally.
Yeah, like the actual words of Murray's tweet were like everything that I love about Andy Murray, like the way he is out to prove people wrong and the way he can use something like that as fuel and the way that, you know, he sort of framed himself as, you know, different to other people and that's why he is where he is. Like, I loved that. And but there's such a power imbalance there where someone like Andy Murray with that following can just absolutely sort of detonate the journalist who's written an article, which, look, I didn't agree with that bit either. I think it's a bit of a nonsense, the idea that Andy Murray might be tarnishing his legacy. I think the opposite is true, if anything. But, you know, part of the reason that Andy Murray has got that power is because of people like Kerry Dean, who have gone out of their way to, over the years, provide coverage about him and, you know, make him interesting for other people and put tennis up in lights. You know, without the media, Andy Murray doesn't necessarily have all that sort of influence that he does have. And it just sort of bothers me that he will know Kerry Dean and he will know that he has supported him throughout his whole career. And he's not necessarily tweeting the positive articles, you know, and saying thanks. Like, I feel like there was a way of doing this, pointing out to Kerry Dean that he disagrees very strongly with the article, but also not just inviting like a huge pile on where the rest of Kerry Dean's sort of work and career is not even factored in and everyone is judging him based on this one article. Like, I find that a bit annoying. And yeah, I just think, you know, I saw Andy Murray added Piers Morgan yesterday about his Arsenal takes, and I felt like maybe, you know, stick to piling on Piers Morgan
Yeah, agree with every word of what you both said. No notes whatsoever. Novak Djokovic has confirmed he's going to be playing Indian Wells. That'd be the first time he's played there since 2019 for a variety of different reasons. COVID, travel bans on the unvaccinated, all of that. I'm sure they will welcome him back with open arms. They'll be absolutely thrilled he's returning. We've reported a lot over the past few weeks because a lot of our listeners have been in touch with us about it on Sky regaining the rights to cover the tours and the US Open in the UK and some concerns that people have been having over lack of match selection so far and court feeds, court streams. Well, we have had the announcement this week from Sky. They are going to be launching Sky Sports Tennis, a dedicated tennis channel that'll be launched next week, and it'll carry 4,000 matches from more than 80 tournaments a year on the ATP and WTA tours, as well as full coverage of the US Open. The new channel will also be available to Now TV and Virgin subscribers, and the press release also says there will be select catch-up content available on demand. So a bit of a watch this space. Undoubtedly, having a dedicated tennis channel is great. Good on them. That's good news for tennis in the UK. Excited about that, and presumably it'll have non-live content as well, sort of get to know the players and the characters kind of stuff and behind the scenes stuff, and that's all good news. I do think, you know, what exactly that catch up and on-demand content will look like is going to be pretty crucial in terms of how certainly a certain segment of the audience responds. But watch this space. That's certainly a positive development. This week we have the WTA 500 event in Abu Dhabi. Rybakina is playing there, and she plays the winner of the first round match between Danielle Collins and Naomi Osaka. Osaka, incidentally, is playing doubles with Ons Jabeur, isn't she? Jabeur is the second seed in the single. She plays the winner of Emma Raducanu versus Marie Bozkova. We've got Krejcikova, Sakkari, Hadajmaya and Noskova all in the draw, so fun things happening there. The WTA is also in Transylvania this week for a 250 event, so look out for fun player entrances wearing sort of vampire type garb. It's a single use gag, but I do enjoy it every year in Transylvania. The ATP is in Marseille without Jannik Sinner, but they do have Andy Murray, who's drawn the best player in the world in round one, Thomas Mahatch. Hubert Hurkacz and Grigor Dimitrov are the top two seeds there. And the ATP also has 250 events in Cordoba, Argentina, and in Dallas, Texas, with Tiafoe, Manarino, Shelton and Tommy Paul playing there. And that's about your lot for our first week re-immersing ourselves in the tennis world after the Australian Open. It's been okay after all. I think on like Monday, Tuesday, we were a bit like, oh my God, tennis is happening. We're going to have to follow it and watch it and talk about it. And it all just feels a bit much. But give it a day or two and we're all like, well, yeah, tennis. Can't wait. We have a mascot for this episode. That mascot is Albert. Albert is incredibly stately. He's owned by the Ganko family, Emily, Josie and Benjamin. Emily is a long-time listener and has introduced the pod to all of her siblings, which is absolutely lovely. And Albert is a 2.5-year-old golden retriever. His interests include eating, long walks on the beach, rolling around in the mud, stealing fish from the hands of unsuspecting fishermen, making friends, and once again eating. And honestly, he's regal and statesmanlike is how I would describe Albert. He's incredibly beautiful, strong man's best friend energy from Albert. So thank you very much for bringing Albert into our lives. We've got our mascots, the situation I've got Darwin into, the responsibility for that in our latest newsletter has very much been shifted to Darwin. So I'm very into the Darwin curse. Apparently it's all Darwin's fault, not mine. David's got Francis and Matt has Haider and Soma. Billie Jean has been at my feet on the heated blanket throughout this recording. She's sponsored by Billie Jean King and Alana Kloss. We have top folks and executive producers, Greg, Chris, Jamie and Jeff. And we have shout outs, Matt.
We have Lara Burgess, who is in Wimbledon.
Hello, Lara. I feel like we've said hello to Lara before and we've been unable to come up with tennis, Lara. Lara's before?
Well, Lara's given us one, actually. Lara Arruabarena.
Oh, very good.
Well done, Lara.
I commentated on one of her matches once and it was quite exhausting. Lovely name, though. And I've been in Wimbledon today. I've walked Billie Jean on Wimbledon Common this morning. And it was lovely.
Marvellous.
And obviously, we love Wimbledon. Thank you, Lara.
Yeah, thank you.
We've also got Michael Simlinger, who is, fittingly for this episode, from a small village close to Linz, Austria.
Oh, hey. Perfect. Like Michael Chang.
And Michael Stick.
And
Mikhail Penforsch. Can we have that spelling? Probably not. Different church or pew.
Well, you tell us. How is Mike? Is Michael classically spelling his name?
No,
Matt.
Mikael for this one.
Yes, I know what Penforsch is. We all know about Penforsch. What about our Michael, Matt?
This is a classic spelling, like Michael Moe.
Moe. Lovely.
Who I've now mentioned on two consecutive podcasts.
Big. Thank you, Michael.
I watched him play last week against Holger Rune, and Holger Rune had a comical haircut. he took off his hat.
Bad things are happening to hair in to young men's hair in tennis at the moment. Bad. Maybe I'm just out of touch, but I don't like it. Thank you, Michael.
And finally, we have Jen Chamberlain in Los Angeles.
Hi, Jen.
Jennifer Brady.
Who's having a tough time of late, and she's suffering with her knee injury again, I think. I really felt for her when I heard about that.
And Jennifer Capriati? Wasn't she a Jen sometimes? Jen Capriati? Yes. It sounds good, yeah.
Does the name Jen Chamberlain mean anything to you, David?
Does she live with you?
Sorry to put you on the spot like this.
That is a reference to a shout out where David declared, "She's living in my house," just to explain.
I don't think so, Matt.
That's fine. Jen says, "A side note to David, you would never remember me. But I used to do freelance work in the States for the LA and Indian Wells events back in your ATP days. I would help out Mickey and Sharko with the media room and eventually did several years of research freelancing for NBC and USA at the Slams.
Fantastic.
I also knew Alex, your mate.
Alex Kennison.
That's marvellous. Mm. Yeah, that's wonderful. Jen, thank you so much.
Thank you, Jen, for jogging
my 50-year-old memory and for being a friend of the pod.
Jen, send us stories of young David Law, please. Thank you very much for supporting the pod. Thank you to all of our friends. As I say, the Australian Open review show is recorded and it is up and it is available now, and it features incredible voice notes. We've got Pam Shriver, Matt Futterman, Hannah Wilkes, cameraman Matthew for the first time on the voice notes, and Simon Briggs as well. So that's up now and available for friends. And our rescheduled live Q&A show, it was supposed to be last Tuesday while we're all still in Melbourne. David's been busy getting well. He is well, and that means we have rescheduled for a week later. It's going to be live at 7 p.m. UK time tomorrow as we record this, 7 p.m. Tuesday evening. So if you've been thinking of becoming a friend, then you have until then to be able to subscribe and watch live. If not, then it'll be available as a standalone and as a podcast on demand anytime for friends of the Tennis Podcast. So the link to become a friend, as always, is in our show notes. That's tomorrow. We'll be back with our regular podcast a week from today, and we'll speak to you then.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.